It is time once again for the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Welcome to the program. In today's program, we will be reading a number of articles centered on disability themes, including a piece from the Braille Monitor entitled Social Determinants of Health, a Framework for Communicating with Healthcare Professionals and Policy Specialists about the work of the organized blind movement. We'll hear an article from Fox 32 in Chicago about a group of college cyclists riding cross-country to raise awareness and funds for disability programs. We'll also feature a piece from the Associated Press discussing the big federal funding cuts facing state disability rights groups. And we'll hear other items of interest as well, beginning with this piece from the Disability Rights Center, entitled Disability Pride Month, the ADA and the Modern History of Disability Rights in the U.S. by Jisu Chow, published July 28, 2025. The Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, was signed into law on July 26, 1990, following years of advocacy from the disability community. This landmark civil rights legislation prohibited discrimination on the basis of disability across all aspects of public life, promoting equal access to education, employment, transportation, and other public spaces and services. It is thanks to the implementation of the ADA that buses have wheelchair lifts, and movie theaters have closed captioning and audio description services. But the history of disability rights in the United States, including in the 35 years since the passage of the ADA, has made it clear that the ADA alone is not enough to fulfill the promise of equal access, independent living, and full participation for those with disabilities in the United States. Advocates in the disability community view the ADA as a foundational victory, but not a complete one. Instead, further protections and reforms are urgently needed. The historical context of the ADA. In the decades leading up to the passage of the ADA, the disability rights movement had been organizing for greater inclusion and accommodations in public life. From the late 1940s into the following decade, the polio outbreak and the return of disabled World War II service members dramatically expanded and transformed the population of Americans with disabilities. In tandem with the civil rights movement led by black activists in the 1960s, the disability community staged protests for accessibility and against institutionalization, raising awareness of the discrimination faced by the historically stigmatized and isolated population. In bits and pieces, precursor reforms to the ADA were passed. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 enshrined the right of people with disabilities to receive accommodations at voting sites, and the Architectural Barriers Act of 1968 required newly built federal facilities to be accessible to those with disabilities. These measures introducing accommodations for voters with disabilities and accessible design for public buildings were both expanded and secured by the ADA. Acts of physical protest by the disability community pushed federal disability rights legislation past the finish line. 1977 saw the month-long 504 sit-in, where participants occupied federal buildings to pressure lawmakers to sign the regulations to implement Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, the first federal law naming disability as a civil rights category. In the March 1990 Capitol crawl, disability activists crawled up the Capitol steps as a visual demonstration of the inaccessibility of public buildings to those with physical disabilities. It worked. The ADA was signed into law that summer. But since its landmark passage, the ADA has often fallen short of its ability to protect the rights and access of those with disabilities. Experts note that there is not enough education around ADA policies, preventing people with disabilities from recognizing when their rights are being violated. No dedicated federal agency administers the ADA and holds institutions accountable to it, placing the burden of enforcing ADA regulations on people with disabilities themselves, who often lack the time, resources, and community support to do so. But the landmark Olmstead case was one such lawsuit levied by two women with disabilities against the state of Georgia. The Olmstead decision. In 1999, the Supreme Court ruled on the most significant ADA lawsuit to date, now known as the Olmstead decision, Olmstead versus LC. The case was brought by two women diagnosed with developmental disabilities who had had limited success with solely hospital-based treatment and had therefore requested that the state of Georgia set up community-based supports for them. Though their doctors agreed the women's needs would be best served in their communities, the state postponed implementing community-based care for years, forcing their confinement and segregation from the community to continue. These women's experiences of isolation echoed the country's long history of institutionalizing people with psychiatric conditions and other disabilities. The ADA's provision for community integration, the rights of people with disabilities to remain in their communities, explicitly recognized and sought to remediate this history of discrimination. The Supreme Court, citing the ADA, ruled in the Olmstead case that people with disabilities are entitled to receive care in their communities, given that the care is appropriate, unopposed by the patient, and reasonable in context. The enforcement of the Olmstead decision has allowed thousands of people to live happier, healthier, and more independent lives within their communities. Community integration through Medicare and Medicaid. The Olmstead decision fundamentally changed the landscape of long-term services and supports, LTSS, allowing many people with disabilities to move from institutional care back into their communities. As of 2024, one in four Americans live with a disability, and approximately 5.8 million receive LTSS through Medicaid. Nearly two-thirds of all LTSS spending goes toward home and community-based services, HCBS, which aim to provide inclusive, sustainable, and culturally competent care. This can take many forms, including direct support professionals, home health aides, and nursing homes in the community. HCBS are available through state-level Medicaid waivers in all 50 states, but further improvements are needed to make the program truly accessible. HCBS coverage is not yet a mandatory Medicaid benefit, and access varies widely between states. Many patients languish on long waiting lists and receive inadequate services to help them reintegrate into the community. And the out-of-pocket costs of HCBS remain unaffordable to many. At the same time, direct support professionals who support daily living for people with disabilities are among the lowest paid workers in the country. The current administration's stances on healthcare, far from supporting these needed reforms, threaten the health and safety of people with disabilities. The recently passed budget bill cuts billions from Medicaid and Medicare, threatening the viability of HCBS programs, particularly in states already under financial pressure from hospital closures. The move by the Department of Health and Human Services to dismantle the Administration for Community Living, ACL, also deals a huge blow to people with disabilities who were receiving support from the ACL's services to fully participate in their communities and access public services. The disability community has been clear in their advocacy. The ADA and other laws and programs that support community integration need to be enforced, strengthened, and expanded, not limited or watered down. The designation of July as Disability Pride Month must serve as not only a commemoration of the 1990 passage of the ADA, but also a reminder of the tireless advocacy and activism of the disability community. The history of disability rights in the United States before and since the ADA demonstrates that civil rights and equal access for those with disabilities have been won and defended time and time again by collective and forceful action. Because disability is a natural part of the human experience, with fluid boundaries that many people will navigate at some point in life, advancing disability rights benefits everyone. Supporting and amplifying the disability rights movement is not just about solidarity. It is about building a more inclusive and accessible world for all of us. Now here's a piece from Muscular Dystrophy News Today, entitled, How Art Can Foster Connection in the Disability Community. A public workshop demonstrates that storytelling isn't limited to speech. By Shalom Lim, published July 23, 2025. Last Sunday, my girlfriend, Amanda, and I co-led an art workshop that brought us both joy. The Accessible Art Journaling Session, Why Your Story Matters, Where Art Meets Wellness, was held at the Bishan Public Library in the northern part of Singapore and was part of the National Library Board's Body, Brain, Being Inclusive Wellness Program, which advocates for the mental well-being of people with disabilities and their caregivers. What made it even more meaningful was the collaboration, as the library board kindly allowed our fine art studio, Rebirth Ensemble, to offer our inaugural tactile art-making session. The participants were clients from Caregiving SG, a caregiver support group, and Minds Community Hub, a social service agency for people with learning disabilities. As a Duchenne muscular dystrophy DMD survivor, I've long believed in the power of storytelling to reclaim one's identity. However, this event was the first time Amanda and I had facilitated a public workshop together as co-founders of Rebirth Ensemble. Watching her take the lead on the art segment while I guided the storytelling brought home how far we've come in transforming our lived experience into something impactful and meaningful. Participants used tactile art materials we provided, such as felting wool, glue, masking tape, marker pens, paper, and pipe cleaners, to respond to journaling prompts centered on peace, strength, and resilience. Most of them live with learning disabilities and couldn't verbally express their emotions and thoughts about the workshop, but their joyful body language and beaming smiles said everything. We could tell that they'd thoroughly enjoyed themselves, as did the caregivers and family members, plus the volunteers and staff members. Duchenne can be isolating, especially in a culture that still values productivity over presence. That's why Amanda and I started Rebirth Ensemble, to demonstrate that creative expression belongs to everyone, regardless of ability, mobility, or support needs. The workshop reminded us how art can bridge the disconnect that many people with disabilities face. It isn't about being skilled at drawing, but rather about being seen. Even without words, we witnessed how creativity brought the room together. Seeing the participants connect with the materials made me reflect on how storytelling isn't limited to speech. My late brother Isaac hardly spoke because of autism, but his art was eloquent. For people with DMD who are frequently pitied or spoken for by others, the opportunity to express ourselves can be life-affirming. It was a great way to create a space where every voice was welcomed and where differences weren't just accepted, but celebrated. Working with Amanda to bring our first ever workshop to life was a milestone and a sign that our shared passion for creating and advocacy through Rebirth Ensemble is finding its voice. We're not just making art, we're building bridges that foster connection. This next piece comes from Fox 32 Chicago. It's entitled, College Cyclists Bring Disability Awareness to Chicago on Cross Country Ride by Tia Ewing, published July 23, 2025. Chicago. This summer, more than 60 cyclists are trading medals for meaning, pedaling coast to coast to raise awareness for people living with disabilities. After nearly 2,900 miles on the road, Wednesday's stop in Chicago was more than a pit stop. It was a celebration. What we know. 31 college cyclists from across the country set out this summer on the ride of a lifetime, one fueled not by competition, but by compassion. Starting in San Francisco, their mission was clear: to support and empower people living with disabilities. It's called Journey of Hope, a coast-to-coast cycling event organized by the Ability Experience, the national philanthropy of Pi Kappa Phi fraternity. On day 46 of their ride, the North Route team rolled into Chicago for a meaningful stop at Envision Unlimited's West Town campus, an organization dedicated to serving people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, as well as those facing mental health challenges. There, the team shared a friendship visit, a signature moment of connection filled with stories, laughter, and shared experiences. It's these moments that give the journey its true meaning, making every mile more than just a marker on the map. The team is taking a well-deserved rest day in Chicago before continuing their journey 1,100 miles east to Washington, D.C., which is where the ride will end. But the mission rolls on. Together, both Journey of Hope teams raised more than $450,000 for nonprofits dedicated to supporting people with disabilities, proving that every mile can make a meaningful difference. What they're saying. We hit the road at around 5:45, 6, and then typically it's an 80 to 85 mile ride, which will take, oh, I don't know, maybe five-ish hours. So we'll usually get to the church that we're sleeping at or a YMCA or a gymnasium around 12:31-ish, and then we'll go either shower and go to a friendship visit, which is something like this, what we're doing here, hanging out with kids with disabilities or people with disabilities. Andrew Fixum, a student at the University of Arizona, said, "The hardest part for me had to have been Nevada," Zach Rosen, a student at the University of Colorado Boulder, said. "It was super hot. It was 105 degrees every day, a slight incline, and there was nothing out there." Funnily enough, my dad did it when he was in college, Max Scott, a student at the University of Illinois, said. So he'd been telling me the stories. And then when the opportunity came to me, I was like, I can't live with myself if I don't. It's something I'll never get to do again. Most people don't even get the opportunity. So I was like, I gotta take it. What's next? The team is taking a well-deserved rest day in Chicago before continuing their journey 1,100 miles east to Washington, D.C. Together, both Journey of Hope teams raised more than $450,000 for nonprofits dedicated to supporting people with disabilities, proving that every mile can make a meaningful difference. Next up is a piece from ASTHO.org. That is the Association for State and Territorial Health Organizations. And the piece is entitled, Designing With, Not For, Stakeholder-Centered Approaches to Disability Health Data, published July 22, 2025, written by Margaret Nils. Understanding the impact of public health issues on people with disabilities requires data and evidence. However, our data systems are not optimized for disability data collection. For example, there is no universally accepted method for collecting data on people with disabilities. Yet, disaggregated data by disability status and type are essential for identifying health disparities and the structural factors that contribute to them. These data inform the development, evaluation, and improvement of public health research, programs, and policy. In collaboration with the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists, CSTE, ASTHO conducted a landscape assessment of health data systems to help health agencies and researchers better understand the intersection of disability and health. This assessment of the broader public health data landscape reviewed challenges, opportunities, and best practices in utilizing existing data systems to enhance the understanding of the health needs of people with disabilities. The project included a literature review, insights from a technical assistance group, TAG, key informant interviews, KIIS, and the development and pilot testing of a tool to evaluate the usefulness of data systems for understanding the health needs of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Stakeholder engagement was central to this project. Health agencies can adopt this crucial strategy when reviewing, evaluating, and framing data to better understand the health needs of people with disabilities. Health agencies can use the stakeholder engagement method demonstrated in this project to gather input from subject matter experts and disabled voices in their own communities. Insights from stakeholders: elevating inclusion, collaboration, and lived experience. In all disability work, it is essential to center the voices of people with disabilities. To ensure the disability community was included in this project, the perspectives of those with firsthand experience navigating the intellectual and developmental disabilities data challenges guided each component. The TAG, composed of individuals with lived experience and data expertise, helped shape priorities, identify gaps, and ensure a people-centered approach. Invitees to the TAG were identified through the literature review for their experience in disability and health data research, familiarity with various data systems and sets, and personal lived experience. Additional invitees were identified through direct feedback and recommendations from group members and were included in the process. TAG participants were invited through an application process and awarded an honorarium for participating in 6 monthly meetings and for additional time spent reviewing material between meetings. ASTHO worked to ensure that TAG meetings were held in an accessible manner, providing meeting materials in advance along with ASL interpretation and human captioning during meetings. Additionally, a series of KIIs with researchers, public health officials, data managers, advocates, and caregivers uncovered consistent themes reinforcing the importance of equity, interoperability, and ethical data practices. In all KIIs, individuals with disabilities and lived experiences were included in the interview sessions. These engagements provided more than just technical insight. They fostered connection and collaboration. Several TAG members attended the CSTE annual conference to share this work and engage with epidemiology professionals, forging new relationships and enhancing visibility for disability-inclusive public health efforts. Similarly, every KII concluded with participants connecting with each other to collaborate in the future, highlighting how inclusion naturally facilitates partnership building. As health agencies strive to create more inclusive data systems that incorporate lived experience perspectives, a few key goals are essential for success. Trust, ethics, and privacy. Meaningful involvement requires more than just an invitation. It requires creating spaces where people feel safe, respected, and informed. This includes clearly communicating how input will be used, ensuring accessibility, and being transparent about decision-making power. It also involves ensuring accurate representation through stakeholder engagement. Ethical engagement also means honoring privacy, particularly when individuals are asked to share personal or sensitive experiences. Trust is built when participants see their perspectives valued, protected, and acted upon. Lived experience and decision-making. Engagement is most meaningful when people with disabilities are consulted and embedded in decision-making. For successful and inclusive public health action, there is a need for roles that recognize and compensate for lived experience and long-term strategies to support inclusive leadership in data initiatives. Acknowledging intersectionality within disability communities is essential. People with disabilities have a range of unique experiences and identities that shape their lived experience. Additionally, people with disabilities bring not only lived experience, but also professional expertise and research skills. Their full participation enriches the quality and relevance of the work, reinforcing the value of diverse perspectives in shaping data-driven initiatives. Building bridges. One of the most tangible outcomes of this stakeholder-driven process was the creation of new connections. Participants often expressed that they were inspired by others doing similar work, but frequently lacked pathways to collaborate across sectors. TAG meetings and key informant interviews not only gathered input, they sparked momentum. In nearly every conversation, stakeholders left with a renewed sense of community and a contact they planned to follow up with, reinforcing the value of structured spaces for relationship building in public health. These insights reinforced that public health action can be stronger, more accurate, and more equitable when the whole community has a seat at the table. The path forward is not solely technical, it is relational. As the landscape of disability and data evolves, so must our approach to collecting, linking, and applying it. Stakeholders' insights from the TAG and KIIs highlight the critical need for public health action that is inclusive by design, ethically grounded, and informed by those with lived experience. Building connections between stakeholders, ensuring representation of people with disabilities in decision-making roles, and fostering cross-sector partnerships are not ancillary activities, they are essential to sustainable, equitable change. By continuing to elevate lived experiences, break down silos, and invest in collaborative solutions, jurisdictions can help ensure that disability data becomes not only more available, but also more actionable and person-centered. The program will continue in just a few moments, but first, here's a reminder that you are listening to the Disability News Program. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'm your volunteer reader, John Curry. Next up is a piece from the Braille Monitor entitled Social Determinants of Health, a Framework for Communicating with Healthcare Professionals and Policy Specialists about the work of the Organized Blind Movement, by Justin Salisbury. From the editor. In the National Federation of the Blind, we do not consider blindness to be primarily a health problem. On the other hand, we want very much for those who treat people who are experiencing changes in their eyesight to refer their patients to us, especially at the point where further medical intervention is either impossible or undesirable. We also often find ourselves needing to communicate our concerns to people who view blindness primarily through the healthcare lens, including legislators, members of the media. Justin Salisbury, a dedicated Federationist now residing in Minnesota who always seeks to apply what he learns to achieve practical and positive results, believes that he has found a way to explain our movement to these audiences that is worth trying. Here is what he says. For many years, I had learned to argue that blindness was not a healthcare issue, but I'm now open to more possibilities. I'd like to share a framework that will be new to some readers, and I will explain how I think this framework is useful for communicating with healthcare professionals and health policy specialists. As many readers know, each year, the National Federation of the Blind gathers in Washington, D.C. for our annual Washington Seminar, where we put our heads together and visit our federal legislators to advance the legislative agenda of blind Americans. In some of those congressional appointments, I have found myself assigned to a legislative aide who specialized in healthcare issues, even at times when I was not there to discuss a bill as directly about healthcare as the Medical Device Non-Visual Accessibility Act. If I went there to talk about ending disability-based subminimum wages, I still may have found myself talking to a health policy specialist. I suspect that this phenomenon may come from the idea that what blind people want and need might be healthcare to try to heal their eyesight. This is not the case for many of us, but the conversation does not need to end just because we find ourselves in the presence of a healthcare professional or health policy specialist. In 2017, in the Hawaii State Legislature, there was a bill that would have harmed blind people. Proponents of the bill were moving it through the legislature by using low expectations of blind people to justify what they wanted to do. This bill would have added blindness to the list of qualifying disabilities for handicapped parking placards in the state of Hawaii. The proponents argued that it was terrifying to walk through a parking lot as a blind person and that this bill was absolutely necessary to ensure our safety. The National Federation of the Blind opposes the issuance of such placards to the blind pursuant to Resolution 85-22, which observes that the unnecessary use of parking spaces by blind persons casts doubt on our assertion that blindness does not render us helpless and immobile. In other words, it is a manifestation of low expectations of blind people. Specifically, our ability to move freely and safely through the world. As a cane travel instructor with a National Orientation and Mobility Certification, I have taught blind people how to travel confidently so that blindness is not a reason to need handicapped parking. Our fear was that the routine services offered to newly blind people would include handicapped parking placards. While I was working for the Vocational Rehabilitation Agency, one of my supervisors called me into their office and told me about the bill purely for my information. I quickly found myself pulling together a team of witnesses to go into a joint Senate committee hearing and testify against the bill. I took the time to investigate the chairs of each of the two committees, and I was disappointed to learn that one of them was a medical doctor. Here we go again, I thought. But we made our case. Somehow the medical doctor really understood what we were saying. He killed the bill for us. He also asked us what other bills were on our wish list so that he could help us with them, and he became the first sponsor of our first parental rights bill. He fought for us, and I decided to help him with his primary campaign for lieutenant governor. During a campaign event, I asked one of his fellow doctors about why this network of physicians seemed to understand what I was talking about. He told me that they really believed in addressing the social determinants of health, SDOH, and he explained the SDOH framework. Today, the medical doctor slash state senator who introduced our parental rights bill, Joshua Green, is the governor of Hawaii. Social determinants of health, SDOH, are the conditions in the environment where people are born, live, learn, work, play, worship, and age that affect a wide range of health, functioning, and quality of life outcomes and risks. I borrowed this definition from Healthy People 2030, a nationwide initiative aimed at improving the health and well-being of all Americans by the year 2030. The Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, and other public policies have encouraged healthcare organizations to focus on SDOH. Several codes of ethics across different healthcare professions, including the American Public Health Association, APHA, Code of Ethics, the American Medical Association, AMA, Code of Medical Ethics, and the National Association of Social Workers, NASW, Code of Ethics, encourage healthcare professionals to consider and address SDOH. Different entities have organized SDOH into different category lists, just like there are many ways you can cut up a pizza before you eat it. I will stick with the system from Healthy People 2030. In this system, SDOH are organized into five domains: economic stability, education access and quality, healthcare access and quality, neighborhood and built environment, and social and community context. For economic stability, the goal is to help people earn steady incomes that allow them to meet their health needs. Blind people who get involved in the National Federation of the Blind are more likely to have higher incomes than blind people who do not, according to data from a 2018 study by doctors Edward Bell and Ariel Silverman. This should not be much of a surprise, since the Federation was initially organized to confront threats to the financial well-being of blind people. We have worked for many years to promote the employment, wages, and expectations of blind people in the workforce. We also advocate for policies and programs that support the economic stability of blind people. We often advocate for adequate funding for vocational rehabilitation programs and minimum wage laws that do not exclude workers with disabilities. We also advocate for changes to Social Security disability insurance benefits to eliminate the harsh earnings cliff that stops all benefits if a blind person earns $1 over the substantial gainful activity threshold. For education access and quality, the Healthy People 2030 goal is to increase educational opportunities and help children and adolescents do well in school. I think that education access and quality are important across the lifespan, including for children and adolescents. In the National Federation of the Blind, we help support students to succeed in school, partly through the skills and confidence that we give each other, partly through advocating with specific educational programs and institutions to ensure that they are serving blind students well, and partly through advocating for legislation that supports education access and quality for blind students. We may advocate for government grant programs to support the training of people, blind or sighted, who want to become a teacher of blind students, TBS, cane travel instructor, or rehabilitation teacher. These professionals help enhance the educational futures of blind students. We may also advocate for the improved accessibility of medical office and laboratory equipment, which helps create opportunities for blind students to study medicine and related professions. For healthcare access and quality, the goal is to increase access to comprehensive, high-quality healthcare services. This domain is pretty directly connected to our advocacy and easily understood. If we have better access to quality healthcare services, we will be likely to have better health outcomes. Sometimes we approach this by advocating for better accessibility of medical devices or medical information systems, such as online patient portals, health applications, and check-in kiosks at healthcare facilities. Sometimes the National Federation of the Blind does end up being a place where people learn more about how to manage their health, even though it is not about their eye health, at least directly. For example, I have friends who have learned a lot about how to manage their diabetes as a blind person through the Federation's Diabetes Action Network. I have enjoyed Jessica Beecham's fitness breaks during the National Convention, as well as the programming of our Sports and Recreation Division to help blind people to pursue our fitness and recreational goals. Federationists recently fought for and got an extension of Medicare telemedicine benefits, which assist blind people who struggle with transportation to medical appointments. And although I have not heard much about this as a formal NFB initiative, there are some discussions in statewide healthcare policy spaces to address the shortage of healthcare providers accepting Medicaid or to improve medical transportation programs funded through Medicaid. Many blind people need to use these programs and resources to seek health care. For neighborhood and built environment, the goal is to create neighborhoods and environments that promote health and safety. Local chapters in the National Federation of the Blind have advocated for changes in the built environment and sometimes for neighborhood safety. Sometimes, chapters have advocated for accessible signals at crosswalks or advocated for how they should be designed. Other times, chapters have advocated for removal of barriers in the built environment. I was once involved in an advocacy effort to remove an anchor bolt that had once been attached to a telephone pole and was sticking out at an odd angle on the sidewalk near an agency serving the blind. I bashed my shin on it once. It created an environmental hazard and served no functional purpose, so we worked together to get it removed. Some chapters have advocated to remove traffic signs, much like deer crossing signs, that warn drivers that blind people may be crossing the street at particular intersections. These are occasionally installed near agencies serving the blind. But they are pieces of our built environment that undermine the health and safety of blind people by lowering expectations. Low expectations can lead to carelessness, and they can also lead a blind person to conclude that their cane travel skills are good enough when they could be improved significantly. For social and community context, the goal is to increase social and community support. Quite simply, the National Federation of the Blind is a source of social and community support. In the Federation, we also encourage and support blind people to go out and be part of other networks in their lives so that blindness is not a barrier to social integration. Through the NFB, I have met blind people in leadership or other roles in their homeowners associations, churches, fraternities, or sororities, and many other spaces where people find social and community support. Some specific objectives of the Healthy People 2030 for this goal include increasing voter participation, deinstitutionalizing people with disabilities, and helping to keep children from being separated from their parents, which have been long-standing Federation priorities. Sometimes, local chapters of the National Federation of the Blind will undertake outreach campaigns to eye doctors' offices to advocate for our brochure to appear in the waiting rooms of eye clinics and for eye doctors who find that a patient is becoming blind to tell that patient about the National Federation of the Blind. I think this is a great thing that we do, and I think we should keep doing it. It is also possible that we could connect more comprehensively with those eye doctors by explaining to them that participating in the National Federation of the Blind can help to improve the social determinants of health for their patients and thereby improve health outcomes. I have tried this and found mixed results. Some eye doctors cannot remove themselves from the compulsion to try to help their patients see. but some of them understand, so I think this approach is worth continuing. I have also learned from my conversations with many healthcare professionals that the best place to sell this message is to the primary care physicians, who largely function as a case manager of a person's healthcare. Health insurance companies also employ case managers for their customers. If we can get the attention of these professionals who hold case manager roles, we may find that many of them end up referring blind people to the National Federation of the Blind. When I talk to healthcare professionals or health policy specialists about an initiative of the National Federation of the Blind, or if I'm explaining what structured discovery adjustment to blindness training can do for blind people whose lives they can influence, I now have a way to speak their language. If I can explain the initiative and the ways it fits into the Social Determinants of Health, SDOH, framework, I may be able to connect with them better than I did 10 years ago. Even if they do not hold the power to do what I want at the moment, building that understanding with them can help to recruit them as a powerful ally who may walk with me to meet the person who can. You can do it too. As long as our initiative improves the well-being of blind people, which will certainly be our intent, then it will improve our social determinants of health. And now, from the Associated Press, an article entitled, "As the ADA Turns 35, Groups Fighting for Disability Rights Could See Their Federal Dollars Slashed," by John Hanna and Kenya Hunter, published July 25, 2025, Topeka, Kansas. Nancy Jensen believes she'd still be living in an abusive group home if it wasn't shut down in 2004 with the help of the Disability Rights Center of Kansas, which for decades has received federal money to look out for Americans with disabilities. But the flow of funding under the Trump administration is now in question, disability rights groups nationwide say, dampening their mood as Saturday marks the 35th anniversary of the landmark Americans with Disabilities Act. Federal dollars pay for much of their work, including helping people who seek government-funded services and lawsuits now pushing Iowa and Texas toward better community services. Documents outlining President Donald Trump's budget proposals show they would zero out funds earmarked for 3 grants to disability rights centers and slash funding for a 4th. Congress's first discussion of them by the Senate Appropriations Committee is set for Thursday, but the centers fear losing more than 60% of their federal dollars. The threat of cuts comes as the groups expect more demand for help after Republicans' tax and budget law complicated Medicaid health coverage with a new work reporting requirement. There's also the sting of the timing. This year is the 50th anniversary of another federal law that created the network of state groups to protect people with disabilities, and Trump's proposal represents the largest potential cuts in that half century, advocates said. The groups are authorized to make unannounced visits to group homes and interview residents alone. "You're going to have lots of people with disabilities lost," said Jensen, now president of Colorado's Advisory Council for Federal Funding of Efforts to Protect People with Mental Illness. She worries people with disabilities will have no backstop for fighting housing discrimination or seeking services at school or accommodations at work. "The potential budget savings are a shaving of copper from each federal tax penny. The groups receive not quite $180 million a year versus $1.8 trillion in discretionary spending." Trump's administration touts flexibility for states. The president's Office of Management and Budget didn't respond to an email seeking a response to the disability rights group's criticism. But in budget documents, the administration argued its proposal would give states needed flexibility. The U.S. Department of Education said earmarking funds for disability rights centers created an unnecessary administrative burden for states. Trump's top budget advisor, Russell Vogt, told senators in a letter that a review of 2025 spending showed too much went to niche groups outside government. We also considered, for each program, whether the governmental service provided could be provided better by state or local governments, if provided at all, Vogt wrote. Disability rights advocates doubt that state protection and advocacy groups, known as PNAs, would see any dollar not specifically earmarked for them. They sue states, so the advocates don't want states deciding whether their work gets funded. The 1975 federal law setting up PNAs declared them independent of the states, and newer laws reinforce that. We do need an independent system that can hold them and other wrongdoers accountable, said Rocky Nichols, the Kansas Center's executive director. Helping people with disabilities navigate Medicaid. Nichols Center has helped Matthew Hull for years with getting the state to cover services, and Hull hopes to find a job. He uses a wheelchair. A Medicaid-provided nurse helps him run errands. I need to be able to do that so I can keep my strength up, he said, adding that activity preserves his health. Medicaid applicants often had a difficult time working through its rules, even before the tax and budget law's recent changes, said Sean Jackson, Disability Rights Texas's executive director. With fewer dollars, he said, as cases are coming into us, we're going to have to take less cases. The Texas group receives money from a legal aid foundation and other sources, but federal funds still are 68% of its dollars. The Kansas Center and Disability Rights Iowa rely entirely on federal funds. For the majority, it would probably be 85% or higher, said Marlene Sallow, executive director of the National Disability Rights Network, which represents PNAs. The Trump administration's proposals suggest it wants to shut down PNAs, said Stephen Schwartz, who founded the Center for Public Representation, a Massachusetts-based organization that works with them on lawsuits. Investigating allegations of abuse and pushing states. Federal funding meant a call in 2009 to Disability Rights Iowa launched an immediate investigation of a program employing men with developmental disabilities in a turkey processing plant. Authorities said they lived in a dangerous, bug-infested bunkhouse and were financially exploited. Without the dollars, Executive Director Katherine Johnson said, that's maybe not something we could have done. The Kansas Center's private interview in 2004 with one of Jensen's fellow residents eventually led to long federal prison sentences for the couple operating the Kaufman House, a home for people with mental illness about 25 miles, 40 kilometers, north of Wichita. And it wasn't until Disability Rights Iowa filed a federal lawsuit in 2023 that the state agreed to draft a plan to provide community services for children with severe mental and behavioral needs. For 15 years, Schwartz's group and Disability Rights Texas have pursued a federal lawsuit alleging Texas warehouses several thousand people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in nursing homes without adequate services. Texas put at least three men in homes after they'd worked in the Iowa turkey plant. Last month, a federal judge ordered work to start on a plan to end the severe and ongoing problems. Schwartz said Disability Rights Texas did interviews and gathered documents crucial to the case. There are no better eyes or ears, he said. And finally, here's a piece from the Disability Scoop. community comes together to make birthday special for boy with autism. By Julia Steinman. Published July 29, 2025. Islin, New Jersey. What started as a simple Facebook post quickly turned into a heartwarming show of community support when hundreds of people came together to deliver a drive-by birthday parade for Princeton Black, a nonverbal 12-year-old with autism from New Jersey. The parade took place on Sunday in Green Acres Park in Burlington Township. More than 100 people took part, riding motorcycles and driving sports cars. Princeton's mother, Zania Black, wanted her son's birthday to be special this year. Inspired by her son's love of cars, motorcycles, and engines, she turned to Facebook to ask if anyone with a vehicle would participate in a drive-by parade to celebrate Princeton. Black was astonished by the instant and overwhelming response to her post. She received over 100 messages the first night alone, with her post eventually reaching more than 300 comments and hundreds of shares. "I literally had to get off my page," Black said. Members of the Burlington County Board of Commissioners, Burlington Township Mayor E.L. Pete Green, and local police department have reached out to show support. Burlington County Commissioner Randy Brolo was especially committed to helping out, as he too is a parent to a child with autism. "I know how special it would be for my son to have something like this," Brolo said. Brolo, who works for the Laborers Union, which sponsors several NASCAR Craftsman Truck Series events, called in a special favor to bring signed memorabilia for Princeton to have. Accompanied with his son and daughter, he drove a customized car at the parade. Black said she received support from several local businesses, including Johnson Ford, a local dealership. Frank Dudley, an employee at the dealership, is passionate about community service and helping children with special needs. As the father of a daughter who has autism and is blind, he feels drawn to helping families in similar situations. Dudley showed the post to the owner of the dealership, who agreed to drive a truck at the event. They brought pizza as well. Three local motorcycle clubs also took part. Black said Princeton would be thrilled with the spectacle, even if he didn't fully understand that it was for him. Black hopes this event might lead to broader support for families with children on the autism spectrum. That concludes our program for this time. We appreciate you tuning in to the Disability News Program, and please join us again next time.